Hey, green future growers, don't forget to get your copy of the 2018 Organic Gardener Podcast Garden Journal and Data Keeper, available now at Amazon.com for $16.95. It's a place to keep track of your organic gardening journey, where you can record temperature, weather, recipes, produce that you grew, produce that you bought, and just all your successes and failures and challenges and dreams for the future, all your garden goals. Keep them track of them in one place, 225 pages that will go through each week of the year for the 2018 year. And just there's blank pages in there where you can sketch or write or do anything that will help you record your journey. So don't forget to get a copy of the 2018 Garden Journal and Data Keeper. Available at Amazon. You can go to the organicgardenerpodcast.com/2018 for the link. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. I am just thrilled to introduce my guest, who's another visionary. I think we have a lot in common. We talked a little bit during the pre-chat, but I wanted to save it all for you because she's also a farmer's wife and a writer. I was telling her, I think we probably both have a passion for biographies because she's written a book about some farms in California. So I hope listeners are going to learn about some farms in their own neighborhoods. And her book is called Why We Farm, Farmer's Stories of Growing Our Food and Sustaining Their Business. And so without further ado, I'm going to introduce my guest, Elvira DeBrigitte. Is that how you say it? DeBrigitte?
It's actually Elvira DeBrigitte.
Elvira DeBrigitte. I'm sorry. Oh, my goodness. Might have to redo my whole intro. All right. Well, go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. Well, like you said, I am a farmer's wife. I like seeing your bio on your website because that is really what goes on here. So my husband does a lot of the farming and I come out and help sometimes. And I used to also go to Montana every summer, and that was probably some of my first gardening experience. And I know you're curious about my grandparents lived in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and my aunt lived in, outside of Troy, Montana.
Oh, you're kidding. That's right near me.
Yeah, it's a beautiful area. And, well, I was lucky to spend the summers there and definitely was helping out in the garden as a child living there and learning about homesteading. My aunt had, you know, animals and big vegetable garden. A little more about myself. I grew up in the Bay Area in California, and then, you know, when I had children, really started looking around for a place to live that was, you know, a little healthier environment, and that's how I got into, you know, organic gardening and the whole organic scene.
California's a big state, and so your book is about farmers, and is it the Quepe Valley? I'm not even sure you say that.
Quepe is how I say it.
Quepe. And so now, where is that? Is it near San Francisco, or is it Southern California, or Northern California? Like, what part of California is that?
Yeah, good question. A lot of people, even people who live nearby, have not heard of Quepe Valley. It's kind of a little secret. It is, I often say it's west of Davis, California, west of Sacramento, about an hour. It's, California has the big central valley, takes up most of the middle of the state. And then from Sacramento, the first foothills to the west is what separates Quepe Valley from the big central valley. And then if you went one more set of hills west, you would get to the Napa Valley.
Oh, so it's between the Napa Valley and the coast? Is that right?
No, it's between the Napa Valley and the central, big central valley.
Oh, okay. I guess I don't know my California geography at all. I guess I didn't even realize that the Napa Valley wasn't on the coast. So, Well, so then an hour west of Sacramento, is that what you said? Wait.
Right.
Okay. And so how did you guys end up there? Did you buy a little farm or where, like, what's your place? And how many kids do you have?
I have 3 children. 2 are all grown and out of the house. And now I have a 9-year-old.
Oh, okay. And here I was thinking you were one of those amazing rock star millennials I'm always talking about. But I guess if you're...
And a little older. Yeah. And I had, kind of a circuitous route to getting to Cape Bay Valley. One way that we found out about it was knowing about Wilbur Hot Springs, which is a beautiful retreat space just, 10 miles north of Cape Bay Valley. And so we were, like I said, exploring, looking for land, looking for a place to be in the country, and this is where we ended up.
Well, it sounds just beautiful. So you told us a little bit about your first or your early gardening. Like, is that your, like, I always like to start the show asking about your very first gardening experience. You know, were you a kid, an adult, who were you with, what'd you grow, like, was that your first experiences here in Troy, or were you, like, even littler in California with your parents?
No, I think it was really with my grandparents. They actually moved from Brooklyn, New York, to Idaho as their retirement plan. And I drove out west with them and saw them, you know, buy their place and then be so excited to, you know, till up the backyard and plant a big garden. So every summer when I went out there, I would be helping with harvesting and weeding and then helping my grandma cook food in the kitchen. That was really my first experience of gardening.
Oh my goodness, that sounds so adventureful. Driving all the way across. You drove from Brooklyn to Montana? I mean, to Idaho?
Yeah, I think I did that twice with my grandparents.
Wow. I mean, I've driven from Montana to New York to Montana several times, but most grandparents are not up for that drive. And how exciting to just like, did they, had they been there before? Did they have it picked out, or like they came out sight unseen and were like driving around, like, where should we live? Or
no, they had a fascination with the West for sure. So they had driven their daughters out West a couple of times, you know, I guess in the 50s and 60s. And then they just loved it there. All their friends were moving to Florida, of course, but they, you know, my grandparents couldn't stand the heat. My grandmother couldn't stand the heat. And they knew they wanted to be somewhere in the West.
Excellent. Okay. So then is that how you learned how to garden organically, from your grandma? Or was it, you talked about looking for a healthier lifestyle when you had your kids, or?
Yeah, I don't think my grandparents were strictly organic. They definitely, you know, tried to limit their use of fertilizers and pesticides. But, you know, organic wasn't such a big thing in those years. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, I was always pretty health conscious. Even as a teenager, I was exploring with, you know, being a vegetarian and things like that. So when I had my children, this became a big awareness that, I didn't want anything, you know, that could be a possible pollutant or, you know, not natural to affect them in ways that I might not know for years to come. So it was really on that journey that I started, you know, looking around for good food. And like I said, it was really hard to find back then. Even, you know, this was like 25 years ago in Berkeley, which is a really progressive area, but not, you know, there might have been a couple of organic things in the stores back then, but it wasn't like today where there's just all this choice of organic food. Even when I moved here to Cape Bay Valley, I remember going to the Nugget Market in Woodland, and asking them, like, well, where's your organic produce section? And they didn't really have one. You know, they had like a tiny, you know, selection of things. So it was just out of that search for, you know, where can I go that I know I'll have good, healthy food I can feed my family, and also looking for good water. That was a real trick too. So,
good water to drink or good water to for your
both.
Property, or like what kind of looking for good water?
Yeah, when we were looking, it was like, oh, do we want to be, you know, dependent on a city system of water where we don't really have control over it, but then yeah, also having a reliable source of water for watering the garden. So we're really lucky here in the Upper Cape Valley to have a few different sources of water. We have really good groundwater, and we have a ditch that crosses the upper part of our property for irrigation. So.
Nice. How big is your property?
Well, the property that I live on is just under 3 acres, so it's small compared to a lot of my neighbors.
Yeah, but that's pretty large for a chunk of California, isn't it? 3 acres still. Like, I imagine is land super expensive in Cal? I've always pictured like California to just be like off the charts wise, like any land out there.
Yeah, we were lucky to buy this piece of property before the big bubble, but it was also, you know, before the recession. So yeah, there's been fluctuating land prices and.
Okay. So tell us about your book. Like, tell us about some of the farmers. Like, I was reading, you know, I was going through the Amazon description, and then I started going looking at the websites of these farms. I'm just dying to talk to. I already even sent a request to interview the lady with the lavender farm. But tell us about your book. Like, who are these farmers? How did you, like, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, yeah. Like I said, I moved to Cape Valley just with my children, looking for a healthier lifestyle. And then I'm a teacher, and I was homeschooling my children because it's a pretty far drive to the public school. And so then I started getting involved with the homeschool community here, which some of them were the farmers at Full Belly and River Dog Farm. And so in getting to know those families, I just kept, you know, having these questions and curiosities that, like, wow, these people are working so hard, and, you know, is it really worth it? You know, and then I just saw over the years, you know, the first 10 years that I knew them, you know, some, you know, wide variety of like years where they were doing really well, and then years where it was a real struggle. So I just, you know, was so impressed with their lifestyle and, yeah, how much passion they had for what they were doing that I realized, wow, this is a really important thing for other people to know about. And that's why I got interested in writing this book.
Okay. And the book follows, there's 15 chapters because each chapter follows a different farmer?
That's right.
And then do you live on a farm that has like olives and walnuts and stuff too? Like is your husband one of the farmers?
Yep.
Or?
No, he declined to be interviewed.
Oh my gosh, we have
considered
so much
it.
I can't get my husband to do an interview with me yet either. I've been begging. I'm like, let's try to get him come on for episode 200. So, because I'm just about to post episode 200, and I think he would be the perfect guest. But I said that at episode 100. I said it at 150. I said it when we were about to break 300,000 downloads. And he still's like, no, I don't know enough. I'm like, oh my goodness. So anyway, so another thing we have in common. Okay, so your husband declined to be interviewed, but you do grow. Tell us about your farm, I guess, a little.
Okay, well, yeah. So my husband was a organic farmer in Massachusetts
for
a few years out of college, and had, you know, really built up his own farming business there, but then for other reasons left and moved to California. And so he's never been able to really get that, you know, out of his system. So he's just, you know, even we have this homestead here, and he's always kind of operating it like a farm. And even though he has another full-time job, and but yeah, so we have, it's mostly a homestead. But then about 10 years ago, maybe 12 now, we planted just over an acre of olives. And there were some walnut trees planted before we got here. So those two crops we do sell, you know, commercially and mostly to friends and family. You know, we haven't had to do a lot of, you know, big marketing or anything, but the rest of our property is mostly just, you know, we try to can and dry food, and we, you know, whenever someone comes to visit, we'll make them up a big box of produce, but it's mostly just for us.
Nice. Well, that's a lot of work. That's what my husband and I, like, well, I keep saying an I because really he does all the work. His goal has been to grow enough food for us so that we don't really have to buy much produce during the year. Because especially I eat a ton of veggies. And then, so his main goal has always been like potatoes to grow, because potatoes, for one, get a lot of the pesticides. They're one of the foods you really want to try to get organically if you can.
And yeah, that's right.
So he tries to grow as many potatoes as he can. And then he grows a lot of green beans and carrots and corn. He's trying to grow more corn and stuff. And then eventually he wants to grow like wheat and... so we can have our own flour, because he loves to make mm-hmm. bread. So we're kind
of
like,
we've
where
done
you guys
a little
are.
Bit of that.
You have?
We've done a little bit of planting wheat, just, you know, a few rows, and you can get a lot of wheat out of a few rows. And the tricky part, of course, is after you harvest it, then the threshing and winnowing and getting it all cleaned out. And we were kind of spoiled the first time we did it, because our friend Tim at River Dog had borrowed a mini thresher. No, I guess he bought it at an auction, but it was like a mini combine that had been used at the University of Davis for like experimental growing. And so he came over and tried it out with us, and we got this, you know, great clean wheat with just the machine going over the field. But then I don't know what happened to that machine. It never came back here again. And we've had some real struggles. Like last year, we just harvested this wheat and let it sit out in a container in the sun for too long. And then I thought, the oils in that wheat are not even going to be good anymore. And yeah, it just didn't. It was kind of a failure for last year, but.
Mike had a similar thing. He grew a little plot of wheat, and then I can't remember what happened, but somehow it got like black spots over it. And I know one of his big things is he wants to grow the grain for the chickens, our chickens.
Yeah.
So he's feeding us our grain chickens. But okay, so I'm going to quit interrupting.
I was going to say, I'm going to quit jumping ahead.
Oh, no, keep going. And then like, because I cut in, like, first I'm like, tell us about the farmers in your book. And then I start asking about your own farm, so...
Okay, yeah, so I told a little bit about my farm, and then I can, yeah, maybe you could ask me some questions about the farms in the book.
Well, all right, so does it go, like, in some kind of order? Like, you went to this first farm because you talk about maybe soil in the beginning or anything? Or, like, I know it talked a lot about
that
the
That would have
different...
been a good idea.
like, how did you find the farm? Like, do you know all these families?
No, I know some of them more than others, and some people I had really, it was the first time I sat down and talked with them when I went and interviewed them, although all of these people I have seen around, you know, at different events or whatnot in the valley, but I chose the farmers that I interviewed because I was trying to get a wide diversity of types of farms in terms of the way that they farmed, the methods they used, and also I was really looking at the different business models that these farmers were using. And that's a big focus of the book is, you know, it's not so much about the techniques of farming, but more about farming as a small business.
Ooh, okay. Well, so tell us about some of the different business models. Like there's, all right, so it starts out saying, meet the young woman who started her farm with just $6,000. Want to tell us about her?
Yes. Annie Henner is a great woman, and she has a great story. She grew up nearby in Woodland, and her parents were good friends with some of the farmers in this valley, and so she spent a lot of her, you know, weekends and spare time at her best friend's house, which happened to be a farm. But she told me in the interview how she, you know, as a child, the whole time she never thought that she was interested in farming. She was going to be an artist, and she was, you know, hanging out on the farm drawing with her friend and, you know, just being a kid. And she went to school to become an artist, and she is an artist. She has accomplished some things with her artwork, but she took on some jobs as a college student that were at some gardens and farms. Yeah. And through that experience, she just realized how much she loved, you know, being outside and working with her hands and working, you know, to grow this food. And she really loves the interactions with the people when she's selling the food. I think that's what, you know, what really keeps her going. And so she, when she, you know, after a couple of years out of college, her parents moved to Cape Ay Valley and bought some property, and she came and leased some of their farmland and started this farm. And just, you know, it was just her by herself, and she just had some money saved up from work she had done over the summers, and she, yeah, just started out with a few crops and, you know, going to farmers markets and slowly building her business.
Nice. Okay, and then another one you talk about is the lavender people from Lavender Cache Creek.
Right.
And you talk Cache about how Creek they're lavender making farm. A living from just like a one-acre crop.
Right. Yep. Charlie Opper as the main farmer there, and he's got a really interesting business model where he's right across the street from me and has a similar sized property, just around 3 acres, and he has 1 acre in lavender, and he makes all kinds of products. And so he started out, you know, just selling the dried lavender and realized how much of a demand there was for anything lavender. So then he, you know, decided, oh, I'll start making some soap. And now he has, you know, a whole wide array, I think like, I don't know, 20 or more products. And, you know, some of that lavender he buys as essential oil. So he doesn't produce all of his own lavender oil for use, but he's got, you know, the farm, and he can offer fresh lavender and dried lavender, and then he's got all these other products that he makes, and he's, you know, does some mail order, but primarily just goes to some farmers markets and sells there 2 or 3 times a week.
Now, it sounds like you guys are kind of out in the country. Like, I've always felt like if you have to drive too far to go to a farm, or like Mike and I thought that in the beginning, but now after talking to a lot of people, like to find that driving 45 miles to a market is not really that big of a deal, especially if you're, you know, you're going to do a lot of sales there, that's just, you know, part of farming. Like, are they having to drive that far? I know California's probably got, you know, because it has so many people and so much more space, it probably has more markets, but...
Yeah, that brings up an interesting question about local food. Like, what's the range for local food? And I know a lot of stores will say it's, 100 to 150 miles. And I guess, that's definitely something for our culture to think more about and try to encourage farms to be closer to the cities and closer to these markets. Cape Valley is, yeah, it's about, I don't know, I should know in miles, but I know it takes about an hour for me to get to the Bay Bridge, so I can go to markets in the Bay Area. And then some farmers here even drive, to south of the Bay Area, the southern areas like the Palo Alto market. And yeah, so I mean, it's definitely worth it for them economically to go to these different markets that are a little farther away. This is an environmental question about how far should we be driving for these markets.
But in actuality, I mean, that's a lot closer than a lot of products travel. I mean, we're in Montana, so they're driving thousands of miles to get to us. So 100 miles
That's
is
right.
nothing when you look at it that way. But how about let's talk about economically. Like you said, you've watched these people, over 10 years go back and forth. Some years they have good years, other years they have. Like, did you pick up any secrets for like how to balance out that? Big income versus little income years, or did they say like they always have one product that kind of carries them through, or like what did they say
Yeah,
and what'd you learn?
different people had different techniques for, different strategies for how to deal with that. And that was kind of what surprised me the most as I worked on this project, writing this book, is that, I thought maybe that this risks of farming, it was ingrained in my mind that, oh, well, there's these inherent risks that are kind of like acts of God, that farming, will have up and down years. And there is definitely, some of that, a lot of that happens. But what surprised me was that a lot of the risks of farming are also just in these fluctuating markets, new trends for what people want to eat. So that, yeah, that was a surprise to me. And just their need to be innovative. So different strategies that people use were one, like you said, having, like for what is it, Blue Heron Farm, they had, walnuts as kind of a backup in case the citrus had a bad year, because we can have frosts here that will ruin the citrus. And then they do some summer tomato and squash, products. So that was one of their strategies. And then other farmers, were really thinking of other strategies, like really being on top of what were going to be the new market trends, what to, trying to come up with some new vegetable that everyone would really be excited about, or different ways, like this community supported agriculture is a really something that really got the farmers, the organic farmers here started, and it's still a pretty, healthy trend. I think there's a lot of people who are still ordering their produce that would come in a box once a week, and then they are subscribing to that farm. And there's also, new kind of competing markets where people want their meal in a box, not just a box of veggies that come every week, but instead having like, these subscriptions where you get like a whole meal packaged to, ready to go. And so farm some of the farmers are, looking at how to work with those markets. Yeah, so all different ways to stay innovative and stay relevant in a changing market.
But it sounds like they all thought all this hard work is worth it, including the marketing and all the labor.
Right. They're all, motivated for, there's a few different reasons that I heard from people that, feeling like they're really doing such an important job in the world, they're producing this food that's feeding families. Like Trini from River Dog talked about how, going to the Saturday market every Saturday for, more than 20 years now, and how she's seen these, babies that, were raised on her food, and now they're grown adults, some of them probably working at her market on Saturdays too. So, feeling like their work, real recognizing how important it is. And then also, just really enjoying being outside, being closer to nature. And another reason was also just, just escaped my mind.
Okay, well, you think about that, and I'm just going to say something that, like, so when I first quit teaching and was before I'd started my podcast, I entered this like Glacier Startup Weekend contest, which like they have startup weekends all around the United States where you can go and in a weekend you build a business. And the team I was on won first place, and one of the prizes was we won a bunch of coaching. And so it's so funny because, I'm like the hardcore liberal, and this guy who just won the Republican governor, or not, he didn't win the governor, but he won our congressman. He's going to go to Congress because our Zinke guy got interior, Secretary of the Interior, I think. And so this guy, Greg Gianforte, he's like this total Republican, but like I won this coaching call with him way before this. And so he calls me up. Or I call, yeah, he called me. I think I signed up, and like, he's like, he gets on the phone right away and he's like, "So, are you ready to create some jobs?" And I was like, "What? No, I just want to sell some note cards, create some jobs. I'm an artist." Like, but ever since he said that, I felt like this, I don't know, like, maybe that's my job. Like, people, like, I think these people also feel like you were talking about that woman at the market, like, maybe these kids are coming to work for her. Like, I think that's part of being a farm is like you're creating jobs and being part of this movement. Like, you need to look at yourself not just as like creating your own living, but also you're helping maybe create a, give some other people out their jobs. And certainly the woofers, these people who go around and
That's
intern and learn, a lot of the people that I've talked to that are successful farmers down the line learn that way. And so, I don't know why I was going with that,
That's
but
right.
because you were talking about how she loved you, which is so funny because I usually tell people I'm like not the market farmer. Like, I don't want to have to be anywhere on a Saturday. But then, like, after teaching, like, when I look at all the work you put into teaching, really, farming's probably like nothing. All right, I can't say that. It's a lot of labor and a lot of, but I think it's just wherever our calling goes. So back to
That's
you.
right.
So tell us some more, I guess, about, so River Dog, like who was it that, I didn't catch her name. Trina? Is that what you said?
Trini? Trini Campbell
Okay.
from River
And
Dog.
what do they grow there? Does she grow just vegetables or does she have a specialty or?
They grow mostly vegetables. They, have had different specialties over the years. They've done all kinds of things. At one point, they grew indigo for a fashion designer who wanted to make her own denim for a project. That was really cool. That's just a side note, but
That is
they,
cool. That's probably something
yeah.
listeners have never thought about doing or something. Like, how do you even grow indigo? Is that an herb or a plant? Or, like, does it come
I think
from.
it's a flower.
Oh, good point.
Or yeah, it's, I guess it would be an herb with a flower. I don't really know too much about it, but they did, grow a plot of that on special request to help this person with her project. And they also, I tell in the book about how they got into having hogs on their farm kind of by accident, and now that's a big part of their business is selling sausage and pork. So that's another part of what they do.
Okay.
And they sell to, they have a CSA, so they sell direct to people. They also sell to a lot of the wholesale, stores in the area, and they sell to restaurants.
What was like the most surprising like farm that you visited, like way of making income? Was there like one that stuck out to you as being more diverse than or something you'd never thought of before?
That's a good question. There's just such a variety. One that was, kind of surprising to me is Viraditas Farm, which is a biodynamic farm, and the owner is really a plant breeder, and she's been breeding organic and colored cotton for many years now. And so that is kind of interesting because, well, while she's really struggling to keep it as a financially sustainable farm, and she sells her, she sells some cotton, and she has some of it made into fabric, and she also has wheat that she grows and sheep that she has on the farm, which she can pull and the meat from. So she has other income streams. But she's also, growing these seeds as a breeder so that she can encourage this market of colored cotton that doesn't need to have these harmful dyes applied to it, and you can get like these different shades of green and tan. And darker brown. So that's a really interesting project.
That sounds really cool. And then I wonder, like, does she dye her wool too from the sheep at all? Or maybe, I mean, I know some sheep are not that kind of sheep, don't have that kind of fur wool, I guess it is.
And I think she just prefers to go with the natural colors. So she'll, if they're white or brown or black, she just goes with that color.
Oh, cool. I saw this lady at the farmer's market the other day that makes all these goat products from, she has cashmere goats. And I thought, ooh, that would be cool. Cashmere goat fur or
Very
wool.
soft.
Yeah. Felt, I guess, is what she calls it. And she was making like these little stuffed tiny, they were tiny stuffed animals out of the felt, but they were really cool.
Oh, yeah.
What's the full belly farm?
Yeah, Full Belly Farm has gotten quite a reputation around here in California, and they've gotten some national attention as well. They're just a really successful organic farm, and the owners are really, they're really advocates for organic farming. They're activists in a way. They're very proactive in being part of like the let's see. I don't want to start that again.
Sure, that's fine.
They're just really active in their in the community and the statewide political scene, and trying to make changes in agriculture, just in policy making, and just letting people know what an organic farmer needs in order to survive. And so their farm has, they've always been open to people coming and learning. So started out with having interns there, and also with having school groups come and visit the farm. And even though, they don't have like a consistent, like professional training, but they have a lot of people coming through, learning from them in various ways. They'll have, maybe a weekend day of meetings there for farmers or
Like
non-farmers.
workshops.
Yeah, exactly. Little workshops and mini conferences.
cool. I like all that. So it talks about like how there's like different challenges that they've experienced, and like do they have some like advice for like how to deal with like when your water quality is poor or your well goes dry, or you know, like what were some of the challenges that they said?
Yeah, the farmers in general?
Yeah.
Or, there's, you know, like Blue Heron was kind of talking about how they've had to go in and out of debt at different years. Definitely putting in a new well is a big expense that a few farms have had to do around here during those drought years. That was coming up more and more. Some, you know, advice was planning ahead and also, yeah, just being willing to take those risks. But again, just really knowing your market and having to put in some investment and, you know, not being afraid to do that.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more of that. We sunk a well. So, like, that's part of our story. Like, when Mike moved here in, I think, 1981, he bought this property, and then we got married in 1993. And when we first got married, we didn't have running water at all. We didn't have power. We didn't have electricity. We had to haul our water. So we started really slowly with just, like, you know, a bed here, a bed there, and then finally, then we dug in 2000, we dug a shallow well. So then we had water to the house, but it still wasn't enough to, you know, grow a garden really. Or, you know, I mean, Mike did really, really well. And then I think, gosh, in 2009, we put in the orchard. And in 2000, no, can't be that. It has to be even newer. Maybe 2013, we put in the orchard. And then in 2000, I think that's when we dug the well too. Let's see. We sold our house and dug the well, 2011. We have bought this house. I was teaching on the other side of the mountains, and we have bought a house over there, and Mike did a lot of work to it, and we sold it and sunk a well, a deep well here. But we didn't have enough money. Apparently, like, we thought the well was only going to be 270 feet because that's like kind of what the average well around here is. But we ended up going 560 feet deep.
Oh, wow.
And we still are constantly running out of, like, I'm just going crazy. Because so then he finally planted the mini farm. I think this is his third year with the mini. Because then even after we sunk the well, we still owed the guy. Like, we were like, well, this is how much we have. And he's like, well, I'm here. He came on Memorial Day weekend. I'll never forget. He shows up at 6 o'clock Friday night, Memorial Day weekend, to set up his drill. 6 o'clock the next morning, he's there Saturday morning. And he was there for 3 days. And I think he left at, like, 6 o'clock Monday night, 560 feet deep. And, like, so Sunday afternoon, we're like, you know, we're out of money, or we might have been out of money Saturday. He's like, well, let's just keep digging a little further, a little further, a little further. So then we had to pay him. And then it was another like $6,000 to hook it up. Like, I think it cost us $21,000 altogether for this one well. So, like, I wonder, like, are we ever going to be able to grow enough food to pay for this well? I mean, that's like twice as much money as Mike, I think, ever paid for the land. And then he just built our house really slowly, you know, step by step, and then to like sink all that into a well. And like, I don't know if we'll ever grow enough vegetables to pay for that well, or I don't know. But so, yeah. So I'm really curious about this. Like, yeah, you have to be, I mean, Mike and I are definitely always kind of on the, I don't know if you'd say it's risky. Like, I think there's a point to where you have to take intelligent risks or educated risks, you know, and, you know, make sure you're putting it into something that's important. And I'm glad we did, because our shallow well finally went dry this winter, and we finally had to hook the whole house. So everything's running off of this new well. But I still think, like, when I look at like Lower Valley Farm, these people, Mandy and Jay, and how much food they produce on, I think they have 2 acres that they have. Like, how would we ever even have the water? Like, this new well would never do that. So I'm curious to hear about this. And I know California's got a drought, but, like, so you're way out. Like, people are drilling their own wells. There's not municipal water. And you talked about, like, how does that work there?
There's not municipal water. And there's, some people, you know, have better success than others with sinking wells around here. Just, I mean, people can find water, but the quality of it, some of it has a lot of boron and salts in it. So there's been, you know, people I know who've, yeah, spent a lot of money on a well that then the water quality wasn't that great. And then we have the Cache Creek, which, you know, some people have the water rights. If their, you know, if their land is up against the creek, then they can, you know, irrigate. Then you have to pay for a pump. And then there's a few of us who, there was an old canal irrigation ditch that was dug to divert some of that creek water to be, yeah, on the other side of the valley, I guess you'd say. And so some people have water access for that. Yeah, that's of course is a big concern with agriculture here in California. It's a huge concern having water, and there's, you know, other parts of California where the drought hit people a lot worse. Farmers here, like, because we had these different water sources, we were pretty much okay. But they did have to change some of the ways that they farmed, like not farming really water-intensive crops. Like, most of the farmers I know during the really bad drought years not plant much sweet corn at all, if any. So then, yeah, the consumers just have to do without or get your sweet corn from somewhere else.
It's been like corn's been super expensive this year, so I wondered if that was going on. Like, I think I've only seen it most of the time, it's been like $1 a cob. Like, I think, wow. I saw it on sale for 58 cents a cob the other day, and there was like very little at the beach. There was one time Mike went to the store and they were $4 for $1, but they were really poor looking quality. And that was only one time all summer that I saw that. For the most part, they've been almost $1 a cob for corn up here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like hopefully the California drought has ended for a little while. I think it's a cyclical thing that happened. So I hope we're on to this. We had got great, you know, water, rainwater last year, and the plants are looking really good. And there's more corn being grown, but maybe, I mean, I know other areas are having their own little droughts and other hardships, so that might be what you're seeing in your area. And also, I wonder whether, you know, if farmers are here might not be growing as much corn and just feeling like they have to recoup some losses, so that can affect the price of food for sure.
Do you guys have to worry about wildfires where you're at?
Oh, yeah. In the hills. I mean, they don't usually come down into the valley where people are growing for these farms. But it's definitely, you know, sometimes in the past, there's been summer days where the whole sky is covered in smoke. And, yeah, it's not fun.
Our sky's been like that for days. Although it's kind of weird because I haven't smelled. Usually you smell the smoke really bad, but it's just been hazy. It's almost been like it's almost, I don't want to say it's providing shade, but almost like it's been not as like intensely hot as it was 2 weeks ago. But I would just assume not have it. I get nervous with fires up here.
Yeah, that's something that I know the Native American community really talks a lot about, having, you know, designated burning at different times of year so that we can have a healthier forest. And that's a whole nother topic.
Okay. So do you want to tell us, let's talk about your place a little, because your husband does most of the gardening, but you said you guys grow a lot of food for like your family.
That's right. Yeah. So like when I go to the store, I hardly ever look in the produce section. I just kind of go down some of the dry goods section and cheese. So I can get some cheese locally, but that's something I buy a lot at the store.
What's something that grew really well for you guys this year?
Yeah, like I said, this year has been really nice. All the plants are looking beautiful because we got the right amount of rain this winter. We've been getting a lot of cucumbers. We grew some in a greenhouse, so we got an early start on cucumbers, and then we also have them out in our garden. So it's been a good year for cucumbers. We've also had a lot of plums and some peaches.
What do you do with cucumbers? Do you guys just eat them in salads, or do you pickle them at all?
Yeah, I haven't really got into pickling so much, but a friend of mine from Spreadwing, she does a lot of the, live culture, pickling, I guess you call it. And I want to learn how to do that. And sometimes I'll just do like a marinated, like fresh pickle kind of thing where you have to keep it in the fridge and eat it, within the next week or so.
Those are good. We do.
Yeah.
Mike loves cucumbers and he pickles pickles, but he also puts some in the fridge to just eat fresh. And last night he actually, so it's Sunday, August 6th. And last night he actually pickled our first batch of beets. He grew some cylindrical beets this year and those are good.
Wow.
Well, is there something you guys are excited to try next year that's new or different that you haven't tried before?
Well, I don't know what we have in mind in the garden for next year. We're really trying to protect our grapes. That's something we're trying to focus on this year. We tried putting paper bags around the grapes when they were still pretty small clusters, and I was surprised that they did grow into full-size clusters under those paper bags, and they did pretty well, but then we still had animals coming and tearing off the paper bags and getting into the grapes. So
that's what I was wondering, what are you protecting the grapes from? Is it squirrels or rabbits or birds or insects?
We're not even totally sure, but I think it's raccoons, and then I know the turkeys have been coming around too. We're gonna have to do some more experimenting on that for next year, because we used to get a really nice, we just have two long rows of grapes, and we used to get 40 quarts of juice that we would make, and the last couple of years we've barely gotten any to eat. That's our challenge.
Before we get to the root of things, we're going to take a moment to thank our sponsors, my good friend, Dacia Daly from Simply Josephine.
It's all about handcrafted soaps and apron love here at Simply Josephine. Located in Montana's beautiful Tobacco Valley, I create everything from my home studio. Currently, I offer 6 different kinds of handmade soaps, 3 different salves, using wildcrafted plant medicine from right here in our beautiful valley. In addition to my body care products, I also make several styles of aprons. Everything is available at simplyjosephine.com. We want to share a little love with the Organic Gardener podcast listeners. We're offering 15% off. Use code OGP15 at checkout. Thanks and have a beautiful day. simplyjosephine.com.
Do you love to listen to audio as much as I do? Have you ever tried an audiobook? As a fan of this podcast, you must already enjoy listening to stories just like I do. Well, the Organic Gardener podcast has teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook. Just go to www.organicgardenerpodcast.com/book or just type book into the search bar at theorganicgardenerpodcast.com and you can get entered to get listening to your first audiobook today. Okay, so this is where we get to the root of things, and I'm going to ask some quicker questions. Do you have an activity that you hate to do in the garden, your least favorite activity, maybe that you have to force yourself to get to do, or do you just let your husband do those things?
I try to come out and help with, I like to do planting. Weeding is, of course, probably not my favorite. I like to do anything out there, but when it gets really hot in the summer, then I'm more reluctant to go out there.
I feel you there. That's a tough one for a lot of people, I think. Megan Keane just like sent out a great article this morning about why fall planting is a great thing to start, because in the summer it's hot and the bugs are eating everything and it's just like you want to just give up. And so she wrote a really nice blog post about the case for fall planting. So on the flip side, what's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
Harvesting, definitely.
How about the best gardening advice you've ever received?
Yeah, maybe about putting shade on the peppers. That's something, that I was surprised that we needed to do.
And what do you guys use for shade? Like, do you use row cover or like just blankets or sheets or like cardboard? Like, what do you use to shade your peppers?
Yeah, just some kind of shade cloth that we got at the landscaping hardware store. And I'd like to, plan the planting so that they were in the shade of some taller plants that we grow. That's one of my goals, but it doesn't always happen. The planning part doesn't always happen.
Right. I totally understand that. That's a good idea to put the peppers like in the shade of something maybe that's growing taller out there. And then like if you put a shade cloth, like do you have to like put it on and take it off, or it just stays there and the rain goes through it and it's because it's too hot there?
Yeah, we don't have to worry about the rain because that doesn't count.
Oh, yeah.
But we do like little hoop house kind of style, just those little wires that are going over the row.
I like that. Oh, cool. I'm glad I asked that question. How about a favorite tool that you like to use? Like if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Well, I personally really like my little hand tools, like the hand trowels and those kind of little spades and things. But I should say an interesting story for my husband. I think his favorite tool is this big hoe, which he got in Guatemala. He got the metal part of it and put it in his suitcase. This was, back in the day when you could do this, and brought it home. And then he had to build the handle for it out of wood, which was easy for him. And and that hoe is, I'm sure, one of his favorite tools out there in the garden.
Cool. I love that story. How about your favorite recipe that you like to cook from the garden?
Oh, yeah, you were asking me about one thing I like. What do I do with the cucumbers? One thing I like to do is actually put them in a smoothie with avocado and mint and a little bit of stevia maybe, or coconut milk if I have it. That's one of my favorite green drink recipes. Oh, yeah, you have to put a little bit of kale in there too. Or spinach.
Nice. Nobody said anything like that. I like that. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine? Or
I have to ask Todd. I don't know if he has one either. I mean, I know he loves, the Scott Nearing and Ellen Nearing books. Those are a big favorite of his.
I haven't had anybody talk about those, I think, since, like, I'm pretty sure my friend Kavita talked about those way back. Excellent. So, do you have any business advice for people who want to get started? Like, were any of your farmers brand newbies, or like any, like if people wanted to get started selling any extra, did you pick up anything like that from your book? Or what kind of business advice would you give people if your book's about farming business?
Yeah, well, one thing I would say is kind of start small, start where you're at with your, what means you have. Like, you don't have to buy land first. You can lease land and you can, just grow as your business grows. That's a big piece of advice that I got from other farmers. And then from our own experience here with the olives and the olive oil that we sell, like I said, we've had good luck, just selling that through our friends and family, just emailing people and letting them know that we, just harvested and have this fresh oil. And I know I did hear your podcast with What's her name with the flower farm in Skagit?
Florette?
Florette. Yeah, but, you know, it is about telling your story, too, and that, just people want to buy from people that they know. So making that connection with customers, that's another thing that the farmers in my book talked about.
Cool. You know, one of the things I talked about in the Amazon review was some older farmers that like retired. Like, what made like did you have anything to say about that? Like, people like, because you usually think farming's for like young, you know, people who are, you know, in their early years and like have lots of energy. Like, but you talked about a few people who were older, right?
That's true. Yeah, I guess they have a lot of energy still. but yeah, there were a couple of examples in my book of people who started farming after retirement and are doing really well. So it is possible for sure.
Okay, ready for my final question?
Sure.
If there's one change you'd like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Good question. Well, in keeping with the theme of my book, Why We Farm, I am planning to donate some of the proceeds of this book to a land trust organization, because I feel like helping farmers have affordable land, especially closer to city markets, I'm really interested in the urban farming ideas and even just, you know, farming on the outskirts of cities. And a lot of that land is just too expensive for new farmers to start. So that's, you know, one thing that I would like to see change and something I'd like to help with.
I love that. How about publishing? Want to tell us, like, about the publishing process at all?
It's been a real learning journey, a steep learning curve for me. But I'm glad to have learned all. I don't know. What could I say? Just that I think, I was just going to say, there's so many, you know, valuable stories to tell. And we're so lucky in this day and age that there is this print on demand, which makes print, you know, publishing, self-publishing so much more affordable.
How long did it take you to do this whole book from like start to like your first like, and what like prompted you to go ahead and write a whole book? Like, have you always wanted to be an author, or like just after meeting these people being like, I have to share these stories? Or
yeah, that was a big part of it, was just my own curiosity and really feeling like this stories needed to be shared. But I have always, you know, been like a closet writer, you know, writing my own journals and creative writing projects. So there was that side of it also. And it took me about 2 years. And at the beginning, yeah, it was just even going to interview people was a big challenge, and figuring out how I was going to transcribe the interviews.
Did you take a recorder with you? Or?
I did. Yeah. After the first interview, I decided, I need to be able to go back and listen to these again and make sure I got that information right, or, you know, get some real quotes from people. So I took my iPad with a voice recorder on there. And
so let me ask, like, more specific, like, how did that work? Because like my iPad and my iPhone, the thing that drives me nuts is the files are always so huge, and I'm constantly getting these, you're out of storage space. And just like, how did, like, if you went and interviewed, like, and did you just like turn the voice recorder on when they were talking, like for the whole thing? Like, how did you know how to turn it on and off? Or, you know, because I just record like practically from when the phone starts till it ends. But then I've missed some things. Like sometimes I've turned it off and then like we're in the post chat and I'm like, oh, I wish you would have said that. Sometimes we'll even turn the recorder back on, but you know, you lose that. What's it called, candid, you know, part of things. So how did that work? Like, did you
that seemed to work okay for me. I don't know, I didn't have too many problems with not having enough storage on my device, but I was worried about it, and so I would, you know, back it up as an MP3, which, you know, doesn't take too much room, and put it on Dropbox or somewhere else, and yeah, just to make sure that I wouldn't lose it in case something happened.
Oh, I hear you. I have a like alarm that goes off every Friday that says back up your computer, and I'm lucky if I do it once a month even with my alarm, but yeah. And then my files are huge. I started like dropping them and putting them in Dropbox, and I like filled up my Dropbox space in like the first 3 months of my podcast. But podcasting files, these are the original files are huge. Once you make them into that MP3, they're a lot smaller. But I don't know. Just, I'm always like, I'm going to do that someday down the line and clean my computer out. And I don't know, I'm always on to the next project, it seems. So are you going to write more books down the line, do you think, in the future?
Maybe. I haven't decided yet, but... And I did tell my son that I wasn't going to write another book until he got his driver's license. So we'll see. But yeah, I do have a few ideas in mind.
I'll bet. And then maybe some short stories spinning around in your head, it sounds like, too. I'm always writing like little short stories just on my computer about characters, and like people always laugh at me because I'll write them on my phone in like Gmail notes. I have just like characters and just... tons of stories. Like I think I have like almost 3,000 notes on my phone now at this point, which is probably part of my storage too.
That could be interesting. Yeah, I could see a book developing.
Oh yeah, but see, what you've done that I never do is like I never get to the conclusion, I never wrap it up, I never put it all together. Like I think I have a dozen children's books in various stages of print. Like that's my all-time dream, is to be a children's book illustrator someday down the line, an author. And like I have two books that are finished start to finish, like every painting is done, and but then I have all these others that are in various stages of, and part of my biggest problem is submitting, like, and I keep telling myself I'm gonna just submit, just spend days just researching who to send each story to. And then, but I always get frustrated with that part because I feel like I do all that research. I find somebody who says they're either interested in biographies or environmental things or whatever the story, animals, or, and then I send it off and then they're like, oh, we don't do this kind of thing. And I'm like, oh, well, why does it say so on the SCBW book or something, or on your website, or, you know, I don't know. I really have
such a changing market out there too, I think.
I definitely, like, I'm sure I have books that I haven't ever submitted to anybody, and probably the manuscripts that are done, I've probably submitted, like, maybe to 4 publishers. Like, I'm the worst. One of these days, that just needs to be, like, I just need to, like, stop and sit down and be like, all right, you're going to send it to this one, and, like, a month later, you're going to send it to, like, get the whole year's worth and have the query letter done and, like, put it together and, like, I don't know. I just haven't.
Yeah.
That's the hard part to me. Anyway, tell listeners how to connect with you. Where do they get your book?
Well, the best way to get it is to go online to my website, which is whywefarmkpay.com. And KPay is spelled with a C.
And it's C-A-P-A-Y. So whywefarmkpay.com. whywefarmkpay.com.
Yeah, exactly. And when you go there, there's a couple of different ways that you can buy it. You can buy it on Amazon, and you can buy it on a CreateSpace e-store, which there I make a little bit more profit, and I am planning to share that with the land trust, like I said.
All right, listeners. Well, there you go. You can go to the CreateSpace store and help support Elvira. Did I say that right? Help support Elvira and also get some money to some land trust for some new farmers who can, so maybe they can have a little more access. And thank you so much for sharing with us today. This was just fascinating. I'm sure listeners, and I have, you know, the majority of my listeners are in California. So like I said in the beginning, I hope that they heard about maybe some farms that they've bought from, or now they're going to support the next time they get out in the farmer's market. They'll say, hey, I heard about you on the podcast. Let me try to support you and get either some of that lavender or some of that pork or some olives or walnuts or just all sorts of things. Citrus we talked about today, and
That would be great. Yeah, the farmers definitely need support. That's great to get the word out there.
Cool. Yeah, because it's tough. And, you know, you might want to grow vegetables and think that being a farmer sounds great, but there's that marketing piece that's always, you know, an extra piece that you got to have there. And so it's encouraging to hear people who love to go to the farmer's market. And, and I think maybe, you know, if you had a lot of produce, I mean, this last time I went, at least I sold some stuff. So that was a change compared to like all the other times before I've gone to the farmer's market, never sold anything. So we don't have a lot of stuff. You know, we're trying to break that bridge from like, we're barely going from small town garden to growing enough food for us for almost a year. And then I don't know if we're going to get to the market one of these years or not. But like I said, I worry about just the water thing. And then our season just seems so short, but I don't know. Anyway, thank you, Elvira, for sharing with us today, and have a lovely weekend.
Thank you. You too. It's been great talking to you and connecting with your listeners. Yeah.
And you know what? The one other thing, I'd be remiss if I didn't say, remember when you get Elvira's book, Why We Farm, make sure you go to Amazon and leave that review. Give her those 5 stars because we know
that'd be so helpful.
It doesn't just support Elvira, but it supports all those farmers. And we just want to get those stories out there and encourage more people to grow local. So thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thanks a lot, Jackie.
Hey, Green Future Growers. Don't forget to get your copy of the 2018 Organic Gardener Podcast Garden Journal and Data Keeper, available now at Amazon.com for $16.95. It's a place to keep track of your organic gardening journey, where you can record temperature, weather, recipes, produce that you grew, produce that you bought, and just all your successes and failures and challenges and dreams for the future, all your garden goals. Keep them track of them in one place. 225 pages that will go through each week of the year for the 2018 year. And just there's blank pages in there where you can sketch or write or do anything that will help you record your journey. So don't forget to get a copy of the 2018 Garden Journal and Data Keeper, available at Amazon. You can go to the organicgardenerpodcast.com/2018 for the link.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And it will link right to the show notes and all that we've talked about on today's show. If you like what you've heard today, we'd love it if you would head over to iTunes and give us a hopefully 5-star review. It really helps us get found and share the knowledge with other listeners. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.